Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, helping businesses to hire workers with disabilities. Information about the benefits of hiring people with a wide range of disabilities is available at abletrust.org or 850-224-4493. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Tempers flare and voices rise in the usually dignified confines of the Florida Senate.
We've gotten our butt kicked. We've gotten our clock cleaned in court.
Also tonight, on the heels of a summit discussing human trafficking, state officials want everyone to just spread the word about what's been called modern-day slavery.
Every time you talk to people, every time you talk to your kids or your friends' kids, talk to them about human trafficking. One conversation can save a life.
We'll also get a literal post-mortem on the Florida bear hunt that was cut short last weekend and get the latest on the plight of those who depend upon the Apalachicola Bay for their livelihood. I'm Tom Flanagan, and this is Capitol Report. The tension was just too much in the halls of the Florida Senate. Relations finally ruptured this week with lawmakers taking the floor to bash one another over past sins and misdeeds. But Nick Evans reports they did get their map. Now the only question is whether they can gain approval in the House and in the courts.
Just beneath every back and forth, every amendment and debate, there's been a quarrel, quietly, steadily rumbling. But Wednesday, and I'm not making this up, that crust of civility was broken.
In this Senate, we can disagree. We can disagree fiercely and sharply. But there's always a crust of civility that separates us from disagreeing in a way that is personally offensive.
That's Don Gates, a Republican from Niceville, former Senate president, and perhaps more to the point, former Senate redistricting chair. Clearwater Republican Jack Latvala, Gates' chief antagonist of late, has been pointing to this last role and suggesting Gates should be held responsible for the state's three-year, multi-million dollar struggle over where to draw district lines.
You know, so far, you know, it's cost the taxpayers. This whole process has cost the taxpayers $11 million. I predict that if we pass this map today, we're probably in it for another million at least.
That bill includes the cost of three special sessions to redraw borders for both the Senate and congressional maps. But most of the money goes to the legislature's legal team, and Latvala pulls no punches when it comes to them.
For the most part, we've gotten our butt kicked. We've gotten our clock cleaned in court. And as attorneys, those of you in the chamber that are attorneys, you know that if you get your butt kicked repeatedly, most of the time your clients start looking around and questioning what you're advising, questioning what you're doing, instead of just continuing to blindly follow you.
And he says if the legislature settles on the map senators passed Wednesday, the legislature is going to keep losing. Latvala says just as it did with congressional maps earlier this month, the court will likely side with the voting rights groups and choose their map over the one approved by lawmakers.
The plaintiffs have represented that on the metrics, which Judd Lewis said should be the tiebreaker, on the metrics, this map is better than the one we're passing. So don't be surprised when we finally, when time rolls around and we finally work this through the process and in January or February or March, if that's the map we see back.
But it isn't just compactness scores. The legislature chose a map keeping most incumbents from facing off against one another, offering fig leaf-sized justifications for the decision. Latvala harps on the argument St. John's and Alachua County remain in separate districts because the St. John's River represents an important natural boundary. He points out districts cross the river in two other counties, and using it as a border in Alachua ensures two Republican senators, Rob Bradley and Travis Hudson, won't have to fight over one seat. Tuesday, senators amended the map in the Miami area, accomplishing a similar feat. Republican Senator Miguel Diaz de la Portilla argues the changes are meant to ensure the Hispanic community maintains its ability to elect a candidate. But it also keeps him from having to run against fellow Republican Ana Terry Flores. Latvala argues little has changed since Gates was at the helm of the Senate's redistricting efforts. But on the question of culpability, who ate the apple at the beginning of this reapportionment mess? Gates is pointing right back at Latvala. The Niceville Republican allows he should have put every public commenter under oath. But after that small mea culpa, he read from the plaintiff's case against the Senate, the portion about Latvala. And the allegations might sound familiar.
S-9030, Senator Latvala's amendment, put them in two separate districts, District 21, Grimsley, District 26, Galvano, so that Grimsley would not have to run against Galvano. Quote, when asked about his intent on the Senate floor, Senator Latvala did not deny that this was the purpose and effect of his amendment.
The Senate's current map is already raising concerns with the plaintiffs and down the hall in the House. State representatives will take the map up on Monday. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
A statewide two-day summit in Tampa to combat human trafficking is now over. And as Sasha Cordner reports, while stakeholders agree Florida has come a long way in making people more aware of the issue, they say there's still much work to do to address the practice.
Governor Rick Scott says the first person he ever met who was trafficked had the same name as his daughter, Allison.
And you can't imagine. Again, you think it's some faraway thing, but she was trafficked by her family in Long Island. She's a little bit younger than my daughter, 23, when I met her. And so she was trafficked from the time she was 6 years old.
He says he's proud of all the legislation and other efforts so far to combat human trafficking, but he adds the state can do more to help victims.
I've had the opportunity to meet people that have actually had the opportunity to turn their life around, and that's wonderful. But there are so many people that we have not been able to help yet for a lot of reasons. They don't know to come forward. The system still needs a lot of work. But what I'm proud of is this state's taking a leadership role.
And Scott says he's come a long way since he's gotten more aware of the issue with the help of Attorney General Pam Bondi. Bondi is in charge of the Statewide Council on Human Trafficking, which hosts the annual summit. She says it's great more and more groups are learning to see the signs, including medical professionals, truck drivers, and law enforcement. She recalls a Collier County Sheriff's deputy was able to identify a human trafficking victim during a routine traffic stop, which led to a much bigger bust.
So during the investigation, it ended up identifying six women who had been illegally smuggled into our country after, of course, being promised legal jobs. But what happened to them? They were immediately taken into captivity, addicted to drugs, and forced to work as commercial sex slaves, performing sex acts on 25 to 45 men every day, 7 days a week. The victims of this case ranged from ages 25 to 35.
Sex trafficking has been in the spotlight, but stakeholders want to shift the conversation a bit towards labor trafficking victims who haven't gotten as much attention. This year, Marty Stubblefield took part in an agency heads panel at the summit. The Florida Department of Health's deputy director says his agency is making strides to combat labor trafficking.
We also have investigators who are out there looking at migrant farms every day and potentially come in contact with labor trafficked people. In our refugee health areas, we do vaccinations for people coming into the country, and we see and potentially see victims there.
Jesse Panuccio says his agency is also making similar gains. He heads the Florida Department of Economic Opportunity, the state's job agency, which has access to places where labor trafficking may occur. He says their efforts center around education and outreach.
And we try to do that by educating employers so that they can spot this happening not only in their perhaps managers within their own company, but also other employers, but then also workers themselves. We help process the H-2 visas, and we help fill job orders. And so the more we can educate the people who are on the front lines of that work, the better able they are to spot this and then report it. And of course, we have the farm worker hotline.
Andy adds there are multiple reasons why businesses should care.
First, it's an evil practice. It's just inconsistent with our values as a society. But if you want to be more bottom line about it, of course, if you're a business, why should you care if everybody else is doing this? Well, It has a lot of negative effects for the society around you. It makes the overall labor pool worse. And of course, if you want to be very crass about it, it's an unfair competitive advantage. We want businesses competing, following the rules, and especially rules like this that protect our most core values.
Florida is ranked third for the number of calls received by the National Human Trafficking Hotline, and officials as well as multiple stakeholders hope to continue working on placing more of an emphasis on victims. One area they're looking into putting more money toward getting more victims into safe homes and not treated as criminals. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Sasha Kortner.
Still to come on Capitol Report, we'll travel to the once prosperous mouth of Northwest Florida's mighty Apalachicola River and ask the question, what happened?
Man kept on intervening until Mother Nature couldn't overcome.
Activists are raising concerns about bear cubs left alone when their mothers were killed during Florida's hunt, but wildlife officials say those cubs will be okay.
Not only can cubs survive on their own without their mothers after 5.5 months, but they can do that very well.
And every 20 years, a special group meets to see what changes, if any, need to be made to Florida's Constitution. We'll get a preview of the next meeting of that body, which takes place in 2017.
Support for Capitol Report is provided by CGI, a partner to government and industry delivering built-for-government information technology solutions for nearly 40 years. CGI, committed to providing IT results Florida can count on. Details on the web at cgi.com.
The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is revamping its water use plan for the Apalachicola River Basin. It's the first time in more than 50 years the plan has been updated. But many on the Florida side of the decades-long water fight worry it will do further damage to the Apalachicola Bay. It used to be one of the top fisheries in the world. But as Lynn Hatter reports, sustained droughts, mismanaged water use, over-harvesting, and climate change have pushed the Apalachicola Bay to the brink.
Apalachicola celebrates the man known as John Gorey. Residents like to tell the story of how he invented air conditioning. The only thing that tops the little-known inventor is the oyster. These bivalves might not give pearls, but what they do yield is far greater. Deliciousness. In 2002, the New York Times dedicated a story to them. The oyster is the economy. You can get them fried, raw, steamed, with or without toppings, whatever way you like them. But it's getting harder and harder to find the oysters.
Can't help but to be an F. You know, like I was telling you, the production at just 13 mile long, you send 3 trucks out a week full of Apalachicola oysters, and then now you can't even hardly fill a pallet of oysters up in a week. So that's just, I'm crazy. I never would have thought, even 5 years ago, definitely not 10 years ago, that we'd be where we are now.
TJ Ward's family has been making their living off the Apalachicola Bay for 5 generations. The Wards run 13 Mile Seafood, which sells shrimp, oysters, redfish, and grouper.
This right here is just the back of our seafood market, and we clean fish or, you know, shrimp, peel shrimp, stuff like that.
Oyster losses are just one part of the problem. The bay thrives on seasonal flooding in the river, which brings vital nutrients downstream. But the lack of floods due to drought has crippled the ecosystem. Oysters, shrimp, blue crabs, and fish that were once abundant in the bay are no longer there. The food webs have been destroyed. High salinity predators like conch and oyster drills are eating the oysters before fishermen can harvest them. Disease is a factor, and poaching and overharvesting remain problematic. Retired Florida State University ecologist Skip Livingston has studied the bay for more than 30 years.
As each drought occurred, the bay would die a little bit.
What part of the bay are we in right now?
We are in the river. We're in the mouth of Apalachicola River.
Shannon Hartsfield is president of the Franklin County Seafood Workers Association, and he's giving a tour of the bay on his boat. His family has lived in the area for 4 generations. Hartsfield considers himself a fisherman, But he stopped fishing in 2012 when drought struck the area.
It's not that the bay would, that turned on them. It's just man kept on intervening until Mother Nature couldn't overcome, is what's happened.
Fishermen have started reshelling the bay in hopes of boosting the oyster population. In some areas, it's working, but in others, oysters continue dying off and no one knows why. Many, including the state of Florida, blame the bay's demise on the Army Corps of Engineers and its system of dams that run up the Apalachicola-Flint-Chattahoochee River system into Georgia. Florida has long accused its northern neighbor of using the water in Lake Lanier for consumption and pulling too much out for irrigation, starving the river further downstream and slowing its flow. This is what water wars are made of. But not everyone agrees the Corps and Georgia are the cause of the problems.
The floodplain itself is drying out.
Florida, Georgia, Alabama, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers have been at odds about water use for more than 25 years. The Flint and Chattahoochee rivers are both in Georgia, and they feed Florida's Apalachicola. Apalachicola riverkeeper Dan Tonsmeyer says the legal fights continue.
So that's why we're part of the United States of America, is that when you have, whether it's a road or a river, when they cross state boundaries, federal law rules. Mm-hmm. And that's why we're in the Supreme Court.
Tonsmeyer's job is to monitor the health of the Apalachicola system. And he says Georgia has resisted working with Florida on the water distribution issue. He, along with several other local and state officials and scientists, have been subpoenaed in the latest legal challenge. The fights go back decades. In 1946, Congress authorized two dams along the Chattahoochee, Lake Lanier, and southern Georgia's Lake Seminole. Back then, fishermen warned of problems, but by the 1960s, the region was experiencing an extended wet period, and no issues emerged. Then, in 1981, a drought came. Retired Florida State University ecologist Skip Livingston says the present collapse of the bay is not a surprise. The federal government predicted the droughts in the early 1980s.
And everything that we predicted in that written report came true. We lost the oysters, we lost the fishes, we lost the blue crabs, we lost the shrimp, all of which were the major fisheries of that region.
Livingston says the cause is climate change. While the region has always had periods of drought, a climate shift happened in the 1980s. That coincided with a rise in water consumption and agricultural use in Georgia. Dams hindered the natural flood cycles that are key to getting essential nutrients into the bay for animals to feed. The droughts got longer and they got worse, causing the bay to lose some of its ability to snap back each time. In 1990, Florida sued Georgia following a 3-year drought cycle, but that one was minor compared to the record lows between 1999 and 2002. There's a rule of thumb that says for each drought, it takes 3 years to see a recovery. Another drought hit in 2006, and the bay had barely gotten back to a normal level when in 2010, another disaster struck, the BP oil spill.
BP must pay Florida, Alabama, Mississippi, and Texas, and Louisiana nearly $19 billion.
BP's oil spill devastated broad swaths of the Gulf Coast. And while 5 years on, much of the region looks good as new, the recovery in some ways is just beginning.
The Oil Spill Economic Recovery Task Force is made up of 28 lawmakers, state agency heads, and business and tourism leaders from Northwest Florida.
Fear of oil reaching the bay led the state to allow more oyster harvesting. The result was a near depletion of the prized bivalve. 2 years later, the worst drought ever struck the bay. The 2012 drought was so bad that in August of 2013, the federal government declared a fishery disaster. For people like Livingston, who fought hard to protect the bay from development, its critical condition is heartbreaking to see.
While we protected it from everything else, we were not able to protect it from the climate change that is occurring right now.
For Florida Public Radio, I'm Lynn Hatter.
After nearly 300 bears died in a Florida hunt this month, some are questioning how many of those bears were mothers and what their death means for the cubs left alone in the woods. We get that story from Regan McCarthy.
The St. Francis Wildlife Center in North Florida is dedicated to rescuing and rehabilitating sick, injured, and orphaned animals.
Here we have the mammals room, where right now it's full of squirrels. If you came a few months ago, it would have been full of possums.
That's Teresa Stevenson. She's the center's director. In addition to squirrels, Stevenson is also caring for a few baby raccoons, a baby bobcat, turtles, tortoises, a baby possum, and this guy.
Say hello.
That's Squirt, the crow. Stevenson says he came to the center after a raccoon attacked his family's nest, killing his mother and father, along with most of his siblings. He fell out of the nest and survived, but Stevenson says he'll probably never fully recover.
He had, you know, injuries everywhere, and then the eyes got cloudy, the feathers didn't grow up, so he's just... Let's grow up, and we love him to death. So he's staying with us for education. We're going to put him under our educational permit.
St. Francis is one of the top places in North Florida for orphaned wildlife. But Stevenson says her clinic is limited in what it can take.
No bears. Mm-mm.
St. Francis doesn't have the equipment or authority to take care of bears. For that, Stevenson says people should call the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. After Florida's first bear hunt in two decades, many asked what would happen to the bear cubs whose mothers had been shot. The hunt rules allowed the harvest of both male and female bears, but did stipulate no bears could be shot if cubs were within sight. But mothers often keep their cubs hidden, and hunters report seeing several lactating bears at check-in sites. How many? The Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission says that information won't be available until mid-November. But the FWC's bear expert, Thomas Eason, says those bear cubs should be okay on their own.
I would point out there's lots of scientific literature that shows not only can cubs survive on their own without their mothers after 5.5 months, but they can do that very well. And so the cubs, we set the hunt later in the year so that the cubs would be as old as possible, so they're 8 to 9 months old.
Eason is referring to a study published in the Journal of Wildlife Management. But Stevenson says while she admits the FWC is the authority on bears in Florida, she questions the study.
I disagree. Most baby bears stay with the mothers for at least a couple of years.
But Stevenson and Eason do agree on one thing. If you find a young bear in the woods who looks abandoned, it's best not to approach it. Here's Eason.
Similar to deer, every year we get people picking up fawns that they say are abandoned and they bring them in, and that's the absolute worst thing to do.
The Wildlife Commission cut the state's bear hunt short after hunters culled nearly 300 bears in just 2 days. And while the overall number of bears shot remains below the statewide target, hunters did surpass some regional numbers. But despite that, officials say they feel the hunt went smoothly. The FWC is continuing to compile data about the bears killed. They hope to use that information to help them fine-tune next year's hunt. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Regan McCarthy.
You're listening to Capital Report on Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally tonight, there are certain momentous things that only take place every few decades or so. One of these is the next meeting of Florida's Constitution Revision Commission that next convenes in 2017. As Kate Payne reports, the process gives citizens a chance to shape the state's important legal document.
The Constitutional Revision Commission comes only once every 20 years with the express goal to review and revise the state's foundational document. In Florida, there are five ways to amend the Constitution, but the CRC is perhaps the most powerful. Proposals don't need outside approval from the legislature or courts and go directly on the ballot for voter consideration. Former Commissioner Martha Barnett says it's a power not to be taken lightly.
But this is the part of it that I think is exciting, but frankly frightening, in terms of the power this group has to maybe shape, to respond to, and shape the future of the state.
The 37-member commission is appointed by the state leadership of the time: the governor, speaker of the House, president of the Senate, chief justice of the Supreme Court, and the attorney general. Critics are raising concerns that a predominantly Republican government will appoint a predominantly Republican commission with little thought for diversity. But former commissioner and former Chief Justice Gerald Kogan says party affiliation isn't everything.
You need people of goodwill, people who are going to do these things for the benefit of all the people of the state of Florida. And if that's what they accomplish, then it doesn't really make much difference who appoints them.
Former commissioners and lawmakers convened this week to share advice in preparation for the review. Speakers highlighted the importance of the process and showed excitement about the power of social media to open the conversation in a new way. But former Commissioner Jacinta Mathis raised concerns about a sense of apathy and disconnection in voters, 57% of which didn't vote in the last election.
Participation in government is a key issue. People don't feel a part of a government that's just run by a small group of elites.
Commissioners hope the process will appeal to Floridians who may have disengaged from politics. Some say the review's lack of restrictions could pave the way for difficult and controversial issues. Former commissioners say the right to die, criminal justice reform, and campaign funding could all use a second look. Preparations are already underway to engage citizens in the process. The Leroy Collins Institute is spearheading a campaign to educate and empower the public. Former Commissioner Martha Barnett says communities should start reflecting now on what Florida should look like over the next 20 years.
I think the real challenge is to gather thought leaders together, whether they're on the commission or not, from every age group and the diversity of our community. And before they really meet, talk about what do we see Florida's needs are in the future. Where is this state going to be 5 years, 10 years from now? What's the population?
Commissioners will be appointed prior to the 2017 session. The commission will hold public hearings throughout the state to research and take the pulse of the public. Any finalized proposals will then go directly on the 2018 ballot. For WFSU News, I'm Kate Payne.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Jim Ash, Sasha Cordner, Nick Evans, Lynn Hatter, Regan McCarthy, and Kate Payne. We also thank our contributing Florida public radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Taylor Cox, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at @FPRCapReport. And please join us again next week for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at fprn.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, helping donors make a difference through planned giving, putting donations to work so people with disabilities can too. On the web at abletrust.org. The Able Trust, empowerment, education, employment. WFSU FM Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.